This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is The Deep Dive on Chai FM, and I'm host Brooke Spector as usual. And today's guest, Emilia Potenza from the Apartheid Museum. She's the curator, chief curator, I'm sure, curator in chief. I'm not quite sure what her desktop title says, but she's been there a long time and she's been responsible for much of its success. And today we're talking about an exhibit that she had a hand in, but isn't, I believe, at the Apartheid Museum itself. It's elsewhere. And this is on the late Don Matera. And by way of introduction, I should say I knew Don years and years and years ago, back starting in 1975. And I will tell you a little story. I first met him when my office was downtown on Commissioner Street. And for whatever reason, he and I had to walk. That's right. We started at the Carlton Center and we were walking toward my office and where he was working, actually, at the Star Building, where he was a sub-editor. He was a banned person at the time, so the paper let him do that job, which meant he didn't actually have to do other things with other people, following, in effect, the rule that was imposed on him. But as we walked down the street, it became a very slow sort of royal kind of procession, because every person we walked past knew who he was, and he was getting greetings from storefronts, from inside of doorways, from alleyways, from passersby. Hi, Don. Hi, Don. Hi, Brazinga. And it went on like that for blocks. And it gave me an insight into the way that kind of, I don't want to say popularity, not even notoriety, but his presence was felt in a way which was almost unnerving to watch, happily, but unnerving. A couple of months later, he invited me to go to a Johannesburg tennis open match. And I realized when we got there, I didn't have tickets and he didn't have tickets. So I just followed him. He walked in. We were allowed to sit not just courtside, but on the outer edge of the actual court while players were performing. I'd never seen anything quite like that. Anyway, and my last little bit about Don, while he was still writing his memoir, When Memory is the Weapon, he came into my office with a box of flimsies, you know, the old style thing where there was a blue or a red flimsy with a piece of carbon paper. And there was this book he was writing, hundreds of pages of this. And he dropped it on my desk and said, take a look at it. Let me know what you think. I'll come by Monday and pick it up. And that was his memoir in waiting, being shaped. And I read it and learned a lot and didn't make a single correction. I was afraid to even make a note on it. Emilia, thank you very much for joining us. Tell us about this exhibition and why it's being done and how it's being done, where it's being done. What do we do to go see it?
So firstly, it is at the Apartheid Museum.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And it's an obituary wall rather than a large-scale exhibition. Ah. And this feature at the Apartheid Museum is something that we use to celebrate and honor those who have made a considerable contribution in the arts and culture field in the struggle against apartheid. And, you know, we have been intending to do an obituary to Don Matera ever since he died in 2022, just as we were coming out of COVID, you may remember. And he died on the 18th of July, huh, on Mandela Day. So that's why we're launching this obituary on Saturday, on Mandela Day. It's perhaps a little unusual to be celebrating another figure rather than Mandela, but they segue well together, and we thought it would be appropriate and apt to mark the anniversary of his passing. You know, anniversaries are a very important aspect for us in the heritage and memory space. And this year has been a particularly significant year in terms of anniversaries. The anniversary of his death is flanked by the 50th anniversary of the Soweto Uprising, which of course we marked last month, and the 70th anniversary of the Women's March, which we are marking next month, and then the 30th anniversary of our Constitution in December. So it's a big year. It's a big year. And these are important moments for us to sort of take stock, for us to reckon with where we've come from, with what we have achieved, and with, you know, where, what, you know, what a way we still have to go.
Well, I could also add that this year, toward the end of the year in November, there'll be an election as well, which, although it's not an anniversary, it is presumably a significant moment in the country's history and evolution and future. So momentous period. There is a criticism. Too many people will tell you, oh, it's all this old history, it's ancient stuff. I mean, we don't need to know this. I want to know about tomorrow and all this. But if you don't know your history, you have really no way to interpret your present, let alone to figure out how to confront your future.
Absolutely. And, you know, Don Matera has a particularly interesting history, not least of all, you know, that he was the grandchild of an Italian immigrant. Father came to South Africa at the turn of the century, the early 90s. His father, his grandfather, Paolo, the turn of the century. And, you know, it was an extraordinary time in Italian history because something like 10 million Italians left Italy, mostly from the south at that time, because of poverty and, you know, lack of economic opportunities in the south. And really, it's a struggle to survive. And most of those immigrants went to Brazil and Argentina, some to America, and very few to Africa and, you know, and South Africa. And his father and my maternal grandparents were part of that wave of Italian immigrants to South Africa. So his lineage is particularly fascinating. He has an Italian grandfather, Khoi Xhosa grandmother, and a Tswana mother. So he really, you know, completely resists simple definition in terms of, you know, how one would classify him. But of course, apartheid sought to erase all this complexity and to reduce him to a racial category. And of course, that was the category of colored. And so he finds himself a part of the removals from Sophiatown in the 50s, the forced removals that erased that multiracial, culturally diverse center in Johannesburg. And he was, and his family were moved to Westbury and what was then Western Native Township and became Western Colored Township. So, you know, and his beginnings were troubled. And, you know, in the early years of his life, he was a member of a gang called the Vultures, in Western Colored Township. And, you know, he was involved in a great deal of violence. He was stabbed and shot. He shot many people. He witnessed, you know, many people dying. And as he himself says, is that nobody intervened. Nobody, there was no sort of pastoral care. There was no sort of parental intervention to kind of guide him, to assist him, to kind of correct the trajectory that he was on, until he encountered Father Trevor Huddleston. And through Father Trevor Huddleston, he was exposed to politics and you know, developed a political consciousness. And then, you know, was exposed to Pan-Africanism and Black consciousness. And that changed the course of his life. Obviously, he also had a terrific gift literary gift, and he was able to channel that and use that as, you know, his weapon in the struggle against apartheid. And memory is the weapon, you know, is a manifestation of that. Probably his most celebrated work, and an extraordinary account of his life and his life in Sophiatown and the demolition of a world, and, you know, the impact of that on a generation.
You mentioned his interest in literature that began to grow, and one of the things that not so many people may realize, he was a huge fan of a particular American poet, Emily Dickinson.
Oh, really?
And when he was called upon, when I asked him to participate in an event one evening in which he would deliver poetry, his own and others, to the ad hoc impromptu accompaniment on the piano by one Abdullah Ibrahim. We did not record this. I mean, I'm still kicking myself. The poetry that he read was Emily Dickinson, of all people. He had this enormous love and affection for that particular, almost unique American female poet who had this unique worldview. And he read it with such conviction that it provoked, out of all the sort of the hardened adults in the room, a tear came to my eye too, because it was just, he was reading it from the heart. And so you have this mental picture of a gangster novel turned memoirist, turned advocate on freedom and liberty, reading Emily Dickinson.
And do you remember which poem it was?
Well, there were several. I'm going to have to talk to my wife. We're going to have to see if we can reconstruct which ones they were. And if we can, we will let you know, because that would be something to hang on to as well.
That would be very interesting.
And he did it from memory. That was the frightening part.
Yeah, no, extraordinary. Extraordinary. And he, of course, was a wonderful performer.
Yeah.
You know, that performance, I have memories of many political events, rallies, and at which he would perform. And it was, you know, it really was a rendition of the kind of voice of the people, you know, in a way that touched your heart and that moved and that advocated powerfully for change and for, you know, against what people were suffering under the hands of the apartheid regime. And one of the poems that we have as part of our obituary wall, I mean, there's several that he recites in a film as part of the obituary, including The Day They Came for Our House, which is about the demolition in Sophiatown. Brilliant poem and, you know, incredibly moving. And then he also has another one called On Barren Waste, which is about how Sophiatown arose out of barren waste, and then very, you know, powerful descriptions of life in Sophiatown. And it's not a romanticization of Sophiatown, because Sophiatown was gritty and you know, there was complexity, there was difficulty, there were challenges, there was suffering, but there was also an extraordinary culture and music and art and performance that came out of Sophiatown. The poem that we used in the on the obituary wall is called Remember, which we thought was very apt to use, you know, at this moment. And may I read it? It's quite short.
Could I ask you to hang on just a sec while we take an ad break, and then we'll come right back, and then you will read this for us. This is The Deep Dive on High FM 101.9. Your host, Brooke Spector, and we're talking with Amelia Potenza from the Apartheid Museum about an exhibition, a display on their wall of memories and an obituary wall for the late Don Matera. We'll be right back after these messages. And as we used to say in the ancient times, don't touch that dial. Stay with us.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, or one of my two guests, actually, Emilia Potenza of the Apartheid Museum, and we're talking about a display in memory of the late Don Matera, and she was just about to read one of his poems before I asked her to hang on while we did an ad and a commercial and a station break. But please, Emilia, read the work.
So it's called Remember, and it goes like this. Remember to call at my grave when freedom finally walks the land, so that I may rise to tread familiar paths, to see broken chains, fallen prejudice, forgotten injury, pardoned pains. And when my eyes have filled their sight, do not run away for fright if I crumble to dust again. It will only be the bliss of a long-awaited dream that bids me rest when freedom finally walks the land.
I don't remember where I've seen that, but is that in Azanian Love Song?
Yes, it is. It is in Azanian Love Song.
When I think of poets mesmerizing a crowd, Don is one of the two. The other one is Sipho Sipamla, yes, who could read his work. And the power of poetry in that period, the 80s and early 90s, we'll say late 70s through the 80s and on into the early 90s, was extraordinary. The voice of poets in a popular sense to large crowds of people who otherwise would probably not be found in a college literature course. What do you attribute that to?
You know, I think that the kind of popular nature of media and communication, you know, during the 80s is partly explains, you know, how poetry and performance found itself in that space. You know, we didn't have telephones, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have the internet, you know, we didn't have all the multimedia that we take absolutely for granted today. And actually, the media of the masses was artistic in its nature. And one of the most powerful forms of media were resistance posters. And they were not computer generated because we didn't have computers. It was silk screened, and they were an art form, you know, in their own right. And I think that poetry and performance and presentation took its place alongside the sort of art and the resistance of the struggle and music. I think music and poetry. And you know, I attended a conference in Botswana called the Culture and Resistance Conference in 1982. Which was absolutely, you know, groundbreaking. I sort of had no idea really what I was going to, you know, letting myself in for. I also hadn't really, I wasn't even familiar with some of the artists and musicians and poets and who were there. For example, I'm embarrassed to say, but I mean, I was young you know.
We all were young.
I heard somebody saying that Hugh Masekela was going to be performing that evening, and I had never heard of him. I then passed on the information to somebody else. You know, I was trying to show that I was kind of in the know. I said, "Oh, did you hear that Huma is going to be performing tonight?" They said, "It's not Huma." It's Hugh Masek.
You're a fast learner. It's fine. It worked out.
It was very embarrassing. And then Abdullah Ibrahim was there, but he was still known as Dollar Brand at the time. Yeah. So it was an extraordinary coming together of activists from the region, and of course many activists in exile. And it was poetry, and it was literature, and it was photography, and it was music, and you know, it was the cultural side of the struggle against apartheid, and it was powerful and incredibly, you know, moving.
One of my real bugbears is the way in which most of the narratives, the study, the political studies about that period, struggle against apartheid, quote unquote, is that the cultural element writ large is sometimes relegated to a paragraph or two or a footnote even. And I find having, my memories are such that I know how powerful and how impactful all of that was between the art, the music, the poetry, the stroke literature, the posters, the t-shirts with,
yes.
With somewhere I still have my t-shirt collection. I'm going to have to dig it out someday and will it to a museum. And all of that was part of a language of the period.
Yes.
That seems to have eluded far too many chroniclers, the development in that period. Am I reading this correctly, do you think?
You know, I think quite a lot has been done on posters and resistance and on music and resistance. But I think less so, except in the academies, at universities and so on literature. I think an element of that does happen in schools, although I must say it is notable that none of Don Matera's work is set in the school curriculum, in the English curriculum. I'm not quite sure why that's the case. It is definitely studied at in university courses, in English courses and in comparative literature courses in South Africa and in other parts of the world, but not in the school curriculum, in our school curriculum. So I think that's partly to do with it, but even in the apartheid museum, and that's why we have this obituary wall, there's very little in the museum on arts and culture and the struggle. And it's kind of doesn't feature large in loom large in the grand narrative of the struggle against apartheid. Which it should, because I think it played a phenomenal role. And I think what we will do is, have a large temporary exhibition that will look at the role of arts and culture. Currently, we have a temporary exhibition on Desmond Tutu and the role of the churches in the struggle against apartheid. And that's part of the reason that we've done that exhibition is because the museum doesn't deal sufficiently with the role of the churches in the struggle against apartheid. And one could go on and say we should do an exhibition on trade, the role of the trade unions in the struggle. There's so many lenses that one could look through, and somehow, the integrated focus underplays all of these elements.
Yeah, well, I mean, you aren't supposed to be an encyclopedia of all things, although the topic that, or the theme that you have bitten off in that museum since its founding, there's been a sort of a dynamic balance between the city of Johannesburg and its developments and the issue of the larger political issues of the country historically. And there's a feedback between the two, but please do more. I think I'm happy to help on the art, culture, literature and music elements that were part of that period. I've written about it a bit, but I think it requires more understanding, partly because today's generation has lots of other avenues for getting that kind of material other than the ways in which, say, their fathers, mothers, maybe grandparents at this point might have received it. Before we finish up, please let's clarify where the exhibit is, how long it's up, and how important, most importantly, for those people who have not somehow managed to get there yet, where it is.
Right. Okay. So the exhibit is opens on Saturday, the 18th of July, the anniversary of Don Matera's death and Mandela Day. And it will run until the end of 2027. So, you've got 18 months to get there. It is on the obituary wall in the reception area of the Apartheid Museum. And the Apartheid Museum is in the south of Johannesburg, near to Gold Reef City, and Gold Reef City Theme Park in Ormonde. And we are open Tuesdays to Sundays from 9 to 5. Monday is the only day of the week that we are closed. We hope to see you there. And there's also an exhibition coming up which will be celebrating the life of John Carney. And that will be on display for until the end of the year.
And there is a there's a very modest admission charge, although pensioners and children get a bit of a break on this, do they?
They do. And I think it is 160 rand for adults and 120 for pensioners and children and students.
No, that's two designer cups of coffee. That's how I price things now. How many special decaf low fat almond milk lattes does it cost?
Perhaps in conclusion, I should just say that the poem that I read, Remember, is one that I often get asked to read at the Pesach Seder, which of course is about freedom. And I always feel very pleased and proud to be able to read the Don Matera poem, Remember, on that occasion.
That's an interesting observation. I hadn't thought of that, but that fits. That works. We should have had you in April talk about this. We have been speaking with Amelia Potenza, curator at the Apartheid Museum, and she's explained where it is and how to get there. I think the easiest highway exit is what, Xavier Street?
It's actually Boysons if you're coming from the north.
But
Xavier if you're coming from the south.
the easy guide, follow the signs to Gold Reef City, and you're sure to find the museum right next to it. We have been talking about a special commemoration, remembrance of the late Don Matera. And this is the Deep Dive. As you know, I'm your host, Brooke Spector. And today's one of my guests today, Amelia Potenza, curator at the Apartheid Museum. And it's a delight. I haven't spoken to you for a while, and I'm glad we did this.
Thank you, Brooks. Thank you.
And we will be back after these messages with the second part of today's program in just a minute. Stay tuned. Don't touch that dial, folks. We'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, as usual, on High FM 101.9. And this is the second half of our broadcast today. First half, we spoke to Amelia Potenza from the Apartheid Museum on an exhibition about Don Matera. But the second half, the part we're into now, is we're going to speak. It's my pleasure. We're going to be speaking with Mark Lubner, who has a range of activities associated with, among other things, Africa Tukun, the charitable organization. The Smile. He works with the Smile Foundation, dealing with facial deformities for children, and I think there are the whole series of other business cards in his pack as well. And we want to talk about A, the foundations, but B, the relationship with Nelson Mandela that comes out of these things, because Saturday is, not surprisingly, Mandela Day. Mark, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
That's great to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
I think most listeners probably have heard your name, or they know of the foundation, or they have some inkling of the work that your father may have done. But tell us now the kinds of activities that Africa Tukun, which if my translation skills are correct, it's renew or revive Africa, Tell me about the things that you are leading. I once saw one of the projects in Deep Sleuth, but that was, oh gosh, that was about 10, 15 years ago. I went out there with some people to look at it.
Yeah, well, thank you for the opportunity. We kind of love the work that we do, although we're very frustrated, quite honestly, because it's never enough. To start with, just to suggest that, you know, we have about 50,000 children and youth in our programs. And while that sounds like an excessive number, to put a perspective to it, you know, there are over 3.5 million young people needing to find either work, further training, education. So really what we're doing is a drop in the ocean. What I'm hoping, though, is that what we've done is created a system, a dynamic system of developing children from cradle, we call it, to career, such that the systems that we've developed and proven work necessarily might be adopted by others, other community organizations, government departments, and the likes. Africa Tukun's philosophy is that you cannot take a 18, 19-year-old, suddenly teach them values that will make them productive in the working environment, particularly individuals who come from disadvantaged backgrounds that are surrounded by the constraints of poverty. Our philosophy is that you have to teach values. You've got to imbue values very, very early on. So we literally start at the preschool level, teaching young children who come to our centers, as well as those that are reached through our outreach work. We have about 800 odd early childhood development centers that we've reached out to with our curriculum and our teacher skills training program and assessment facilities, as well as our own centers. And we teach early childhood development values, obviously leading into competencies and skills that are necessary for children who are about to enter into the schooling environment. So we start with literally 3-year-olds all the way through to 7-year-olds. And then we run an after-schools program where children come to us after their school day, come to our centers, places of safety, places where they can, I want to call it, innovate, to experience what it's like to be secure, safe, loved, incentivized, motivated, primarily to get rid of this mindset of because I'm living in poverty, I therefore am a victim. So we shake that victim mentality and give these young individuals a sense that they can. Regulated programs, they're quite specific. Every day there is a curriculum at all of our six centers now, in fact, across the country. Ultimately leading to helping individuals with their school grades, but at the same time enabling them to participate in sports and recreation and addressing things like food and nutrition, leading them ultimately towards career guidance. Once those youth have left the schooling environment, we offer access to bursaries, limited, unfortunately, budget constrained. But then those that don't go on to tertiary education, we offer access into learnerships, work experience programs, and hopefully ultimately leading to employment. Unfortunately, too few are actually finding employment in the formal sector. So what we're having to do is pivot and teach young individuals how to become independently capable of starting their own small businesses, offering their services on the worldwide internet, that type of stuff. So it's very much a sort of what we call, as I say, cradle to career philosophy. And it's essentially something that is offered enabling children literally from the ages of 2 to 3 years of age all the way through to the ages of mid-20s.
And this is a program that is privately endowed. I don't know whether there's any government funding in it, but it's mostly.
We do contract with government, though. So we don't get government grants. What we do get are government contracts, which we have to necessarily perform against. And invariably, those contracts are, you know, fiscally very tight. But they're a necessity, because the more young individuals that we can put through the system, obviously we believe the better the outcome.
And where did this get inspired from? How did it begin? That's something that listeners may not be aware of.
Well, I think it's a fabulous story. I mean, and it just shows how, you know, how the universe, how Hashem necessarily conspires to make things happen that are supposed to happen. So my late father, Bertie, had reached a particular pinnacle within his own career. He was joint chief executive officer of the PG Glass Group, together with his brother, Ronnie. And the group had reached a point where the operational activities that my dad had been running and responsible for were in fact sold off. And so my dad felt that he didn't want to really go and impose on the glass side of PG, which was really the business that his brother was running. And so he started to get much more actively involved in community. He had always been a community-minded, community-engaged individual. I don't think there were too many communal activities that he wasn't involved in at some stage. So he came up with this idea that post-apartheid, we have to give back. We've got to do something to rectify the wrongs of the past. And together with the late Chief Rabbi Harris, they formulated the idea of Ma Africa Tikkun. Initially, it was designed to be an initiative where what would happen would be a number of Jewish communal activities focused on disadvantaged communities would come together. But, you know, everybody wants to be a captain. Not too many people want to merge their enterprises all together under one banner. And so they started embarking on a series of projects, caregiving projects. Elderly people in Alexander Township needed their homes built. Children in Orange Farm were faced with problems of food security because many of the farms were closing up as farmers were immigrating in mass post-apartheid. And so they started a series of, I want to call them almost ad hoc projects across the country, which were designed to address community needs in specific situations and circumstances. And Mandela was approached because he had been a connection of my father's. My father, my family had in fact helped the Mandela children whilst Mandela was in prison. That helped with their education. So there was a relationship that had been established with Mandela. Kind of long story short, he became the patron of the organization very, very early on. I joined about 21 years ago and felt that the various programs and projects that were being run by Africa Tikkun, albeit well run, were not necessarily sustainable post my father's passing. There wasn't sort of a golden thread leading to an outcome. It was very much, as I say, a vanilla philanthropic program and project. And to a large extent driven by my dad saying, well, I'll put up X amount, and went to connections of his in the corporate world to say, will you match? And my sense was that what we needed is an outcome of young individuals, whoever they were helped or assisted, would ultimately find their way into jobs. So we created this concept of Cradle to Career. And it took us a good 12 years to develop enough generically as we moved from early child development into an after schools program into job skills training programs until we could actually have sufficient evidence that the concept worked. So that was really pretty, you know, a long-winded rather story as to the start and the development of Tikkun.
And we're going to take an ad break. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today is Mark Lubner of Africa Tikkun. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is, in fact, the Deep Dive, as you know, and my guest today, Mark Lubner of Africa Tikkun and Smile Foundation. But we're talking to him today in particular because tomorrow is Mandela Day, and the Lubner family has, in various ways and shapes, had connections with Mandela and the Mandela family. And we didn't get to talking yet about the Smile Foundation, but apparently there is a connection there, too. Tell us, if you can even be more concise than the concise version, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Very briefly, and you'll please forgive me if ego is coming into this, but it's one of my sort of prized life experiences. I received a call one day from Mandela's office. I think that the call had been put through to the wrong Lubna. I think they were looking for my dad. Anyhow, the call came through to me, and Mandela asked me to assist to obtain surgery for one particular child who he had made a commitment to. The child was suffering from a condition of facial paralysis. I won't go into all the medical reasons why, but the skill base didn't exist in the country. And I think Madiba thought that maybe if we just wrote out a check, we would get somebody from the private sector to operate on her. In doing some research, found that what we had to do was bring a team of surgeons out from overseas. And so together with Mandela's support, and when I say his support, literally, I used to meet with him in his office and at times in his home, we conceptualized this idea of creating an organization that would not only address one child who had this facial paralysis condition, but we would address children with cleft lip and palates, burn victims and craniosacral conditions, but children who came from disadvantaged backgrounds who were unlikely to be able to get access to first world private medical care unless they were one of the select few going into the public sector hospitals. And then when we looked at the budget that the public sector hospitals had to service such a huge population, we realized that there was a role for Smile Foundation to help facilitate by paying for consumables, by providing the logistical support, by orchestrating together in partnership with these various state hospitals. And today, Smile Foundation operates across the country throughout the course of the year, helping approximately in the order of about 1,000 children a year to obtain various forms of surgical intervention, psychosocial support. And we also provide skills training, it's become a big part of our budget, for surgeons and nurses in these state facilities. It's a magnificent public-private partnership, or NGO public partnership, because hospitals make their facilities available to us, and then we orchestrate, organize together with hospital staff the necessary consumables and the likes, as well as provide the psychological support to parents and their children. And it works. It works exceptionally well. Number of young children who pass through these hospitals getting the surgeries that they need and then are fed actually into organizations like Africa Tikkun, who've got a disability inclusion program, which my family have been driving very hard for the last number of years.
Have hit upon the magic word, of course, which is partnerships. In this case, between public hospitals, physicians, your foundation, and the participation, obviously, of the patient and their families and the community that helps to push them into the process. Mark, I'm sorry, we don't have a whole lot of time, but let me just pull things to a conclusion and saying, because Saturday is Mandela Day, is there anything special that you and your various foundations and enterprises are doing to help mark this, not a holiday precisely, but it's a commemoration day?
Well, every one of the Africa Tikkun centers has an activity going on. It's been remarkable, the corporate reaction and support. But for years, corporates have come to do something within township communities. And we are open and amenable to anybody who would like to kind of volunteer. We've got programs where we are painting shacks, we're rubbing some of our classrooms. The Smile Foundation, I have been fortunate to be part of a development called 9 Yards. In Rosebank, we're going to be hosting Smile Foundation at 9 Yards, where A, we're raising funds to have 9 surgeries performed, but B, we're also packing food parcels within the 9 Yard facility that we will then be distributing, both, you know, warm willies, blankets, food parcels and the likes that we'll then be distributing into hospitals for children who come from disadvantaged backgrounds and are faced with the double whammy of also having to have surgical interventions. And just to conclude, You touched on a particular point or raised on a particular point, this concept of partnerships. The only way we are truly going to make a material difference in this country is when we each stop doing our own individual things and start collaborating collectively together. The impact of our combined efforts is what's going to be needed, quite honestly, to move the needle.
9 yards is just down the road from my house, and I will make a point of swinging past to your endeavors there. It's a good place. It draws a huge crowd of people who are young and eager and interested in all manner of things. And this has been The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, on High FM 101.9. And today's program, we had a conversation with Amelia Potenza of the Apartheid Museum about their memory wall for Don Matera. And then the second half of the program was, of course, Mark Lubner on Smile Foundation and Africa Tikkun, and in connection with Mandela Day. You all have a good weekend. Be safe, be careful. We'll be back next week.